Good morning. This morning, I thought I would talk a little bit about dualism in our thinking. There's a little section in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, of Suzuki Roshi's called No Dualism. So Zen is not dualistic. It's about no dualism. But what exactly does that mean? There's a lot that we can say about this. And in fact, so much so, I'm kind of overwhelmed with where to begin. But dualistic thinking pretty much enters into all of our thinking. In fact, to the extent that we're conceptualizing, there it is. It's dualism is right there. In dualistic thinking, that we end up with a hierarchy, and this is better, this is higher, this is, that's dualistic. And we don't have dualism in Zen. And I want to say a little bit more about that this morning. How our dualistic thinking gets us into all kinds of trouble, causes a lot of pain and worry, fear, anxiety for us, and needlessly, because in fact we don't live in dualism, we only think in dualistic terms. And there's a reason for that, and it's quite necessary. It's not that it's bad or wrong, but we get caught up in our thinking that the way we've framed it in our mind, the way we've divided things out and separated things up in our minds, is, you know, somehow connected with reality. Well, perhaps it is connected with reality, but it isn't reality. And of course, we all create different kinds of structures in our minds. And when we're really holding tightly to the way we see it, the way we've structured it, the way we've been taught to see it, we meet up with those who look at things in a different way. The next thing you know, we've got grounds for, you're in real trouble here, fighting and difficulty. So this is a huge problem for human beings. But we say that basically Zen teaching is non-dualistic. If you can really learn this and appreciate just what this means and the subtlety of it, well, first of all, not only will you finally understand Zen teachings, but you will eliminate a great source of trouble and difficulty in your life. I was going to look at different ways we get caught up in dualism this morning. One of the ways I think is very, it shows up in so many different ways. We get to thinking that maybe, well, we have I think there's a piece of music by Claude Debussy, the sacred and profane dances. And so we have this kind of, there's a dualism right there. Some things are sacred, some things profane, you know, worldly or whatever. Sacred and profane. Kind of a dualism there. You know, and of course the sacred, this is good. Maybe we want to aspire to that in some way. On the other hand, we kind of like the profane too, you know. We don't want to really leave that behind entirely. But then we think maybe we should, you know, we really should leave that and go through. So we get, when we start thinking in these terms, you see, we have all kinds of fighting that goes on, not just between us and other people, but even within our own minds. And that leads to all kinds of difficulty there. But in Zen, we have the tenth precept. The tenth precept is not to abuse the three treasures, you know, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And Bodhidharma interprets that, if you recall, some of you know this. Bodhidharma says that not having a dualistic view of ordinary and enlightened is called the precept of not abusing the three treasures. Not having a dualistic view. See, in our ordinary thinking, we do have a dualistic view. There are those who are enlightened, the Buddhas, who are, you know, these people who become enlightened. They become something special, maybe something kind of superhuman. And they're different. They're removed from the rest of us who are deluded. You know, ordinary people. That's dualistic thinking. And Zen is about freeing us from making this kind of mistake, getting caught up in this way. Certainly we can make this distinction between ordinary and enlightened. But we have to realize that this distinction is only something that is going on within our minds. It is not going on in reality. And I think perhaps the easiest way to talk about this, which I have repeatedly, is that there isn't any particular one who is enlightened. There isn't any particular one who is deluded. But when we think in these terms, that alone is dualistic. As soon as we think that we have one here, you know, deluded or enlightened, you know, as soon as you think you have a self here, as soon as you think you have an other here, now we have dualism. And of course, at this point, as soon as we have dualism, it's very easy to see this kind of stretched out in some kind of hierarchical fashion. And of course, then we would say here that if we have any appreciation of Buddhist teachings, and we think that, the enlightened one is the ideal, and of course I want that, and I will enter into all of this meditation practice and whatever, so that I can attain that. All of this is dualistic thinking. And in Zen, we're told repeatedly, in so many different ways, that this dualism that we find within our thinking is incorrect. It doesn't match reality. And we're told this, and we can nod, and we can grasp that intellectually. But what we need to do is don't just project it out there, and you're thinking about your dualism. Yes, that's, of course, that's no good. Yeah, no, that's very great. Yeah, you know, and we're thinking like this. Digest it. Take it in. Realize in each moment in what you're doing, just what is this pointing to? Because we can't actually say, because whatever we do say is dualistic, just by the very nature that it's been said, that it's been verbalized, put into a conceptual form. But what is it pointing to? This is what we need to take to heart and to digest. This is what Zen teaching and practice is all about. And at some point we have to take this to heart. And of course, it isn't like, oh boy, I took it to heart, now I got it. No, it doesn't work like that either. We have to come back to this repeatedly and soak in it and come back to it, remind ourselves of it again and again, very gently, very slowly. We can really digest what this very subtle and profound and liberating teaching is pointing out to us. This takes some time, but the most important step there is to take this to heart. You have to take. You can't always be just some intellectual understanding, some grasping out there. We have to take this to heart and to see in this moment, we put it into practice. Of course, in the next moment, we're off again. We're thinking we're caught up in our busy lives or whatever. But at the next opportunity, you come and listen to a talk or come and sit in meditation or whatever. These opportunities are always given. They're always present. They keep returning to us. At some point, we can take this to heart and begin to understand what it is that we're doing here and to start to recognize the dualistic thinking that is taking place within our mind. And this applies, like in the case of Zen Hire, that some positions here are better, more worthy than... No. You know, I don't see it that way. And you shouldn't see it that way either. Say someone gets ordained now, are they better? Are they better in Steve's eyes? Is this a better person now or something? No, it doesn't mean that at all. Again, Zen practice is about when you're in these different situations and you see this, you see that. It could be any number of things here. Meet these people, whatever. The good Zen student... The Zen student, meaning one who's actually practicing as a Zen student, now in this moment, what are they doing? They are watching their own mind, grasping, making judgments about this or judgments about that. There is this and that within the world, but they're watching how it is that we begin to string all this out, how it is that we're reaching for this thing now that we've determined to be good. I want that. This is sacred. This is... We're watching for this, noticing how it is that we're doing this, so we don't get caught up in it. Because there is no basis for this hierarchy in reality. That it is all necessary, it is all real, all profound. Diamond or dung, doesn't matter. It all has a place here. And we can't live without any of it. I caught some of the Bill Moyers this past week. Not Earth in the Balance, Earth on Edge, yes. you have a chance to see that, they might air that again. I highly recommend looking at that. But they were looking at the situation that we're in now today, how precarious, you know, this spaceship Earth, how precarious it's becoming here, the way we're fouling our environment. Very serious. They're showing how the, like down in Brazil, the mangroves that were being destroyed, you know, bulldozed up, and the trees all being cut down and whatever for different kinds of developments, hotels and things that were being built. And then how this, all of the kind of silt and stuff that would come down from the rivers that would be caught in the mangroves, and all the life that depended on the mangroves because of the rich nutrients that were coming down and being trapped in this area. All this now is being flushed out, the life that lived in the mangroves, all dead in these areas. Like, what is it? What did they say? Something like 60% of it now is missing, is gone. And they're still developing at a great pace. And the offshore, the coral reefs are now dying because of this imbalance now in the silt, all that silt coming out and whatever. They can't get enough sunlight in the coral reefs. And then, of course, there's all this different kinds of aquatic life that lives in the coral reef. And then and somebody said, well, why should you care? I think it was Milton Moyer said, why should some Americans sitting back here at home looking at this on TV, why should you care? And then they pointed out, because this is all interconnected. We can't throw any of it away. But this is in our dualistic thinking. We think that we can. We think that this is separate from that. We don't realize that we've only made this distinction, this division within our mind, that the mangrove is not separate from you, even though you may never visit a mangrove in your life. But it is not something separate from you or from any of us. You know, the birds that spend their summers up here, where do they go in the winter? They go down to those places. But it isn't even such direct connections as that. There's all kinds of other connections as well. Well, they showed this repeatedly around the globe, places in South Africa and in Kansas and British Columbia and other places around the globe, and how we're causing this kind of damage. And we don't even realize what we're doing. We are destroying ourselves. We're destroying the very basis upon which we live. And we're all interconnected here. If we don't think in dualistic terms, or if we're not totally caught up in our dualistic thinking, let's put it that way, because we have to think in dualistic terms. But if we can look beyond it, we can see that there is this reality that where nothing can be removed and thrown out. It is all there. It's all part of it. One of the ecologists that they were interviewing there talked about how wonderful this was. He was a tropical forest ecologist, and he was pointing out how nature did all of this. There was no, what's the word we like to use, management. Nobody was managing these forests, and yet they produced all this life, and the rivers were running clear, and they supported the things that would flow out into the ocean, the nutrients, whatever flow out, and it also work together with the life of the ocean and all of this. And oh, it was all so interconnected. And yet nobody was managing it, he said. This also feeds right into another, the most profound insight of the Buddha. And that has to do with our will, our intent. And we step into a situation, we think we need to manage it. Now, certain little situations, maybe we do need to manage to some degree. But on the whole, we don't need to manage. Not only do we not need to manage it, we can't manage it. And if we try to, we will make a mess of it. Because we will be operating out of our dualistic thought. And nature itself isn't dualistic. It doesn't throw anything out. It doesn't do this because I think this would work better if we just did this over here. We're always operating from the idea that, well, I'd like to do this to make it better. I talked about how in South Africa, how the Afrikaners, when they first came down from Europe, and they liked forests. They went into this area where they didn't have any forests, so they planted a bunch of trees. Then all the rivers dried up because it just took too much of the water. Now they're trying to remove all of the trees that weren't indigenous to that area, and sure enough, it's like somebody just turned the water back on. The streams are starting to flow again. But see, we'll step into a situation, we think, well, this would be good if we did it, but we don't really, you cannot realize, you cannot know all the interconnections of it all. But what it is that we are reaching for and are grasping and our understanding is coming out of our dualistic thinking, seeing everything as separate. And we can manage this and that, but we don't realize that you can't manage this as if it was something by itself. It's connected to everything else. What we need to do is to start to recognize that this is an aspect of the world, of reality. It's non-dualistic. And we need to start to appreciate how it is that we, in our thinking, are dualistic and how this doesn't match reality. And thereby we can begin to learn how it is that we can actually live in this natural tapestry without really making a mess of it. And we can learn this. It isn't that we have to just completely hands off of everything. No, not completely. We can't do that anyway. But we can certainly learn quite a bit about how the natural world does operate and learn. We are intelligent creatures. We can learn to comply, to understand something about these systems. But the most basic thing is that it is all operating without intention. It is all operating out of the whole. It is the dynamic of the whole itself that is working. And all the animals and the plants, but for us, for the most part, are complying. To some degree, maybe the individual animals aren't, because maybe they have some will, some intent, yeah. But they don't have the power of technology that we have and our ability to alter this planet in such a way. And we really have no idea of what it is that we're doing. And it is always myopic, very, very short-sighted and limited whenever we operate. We need to appreciate this. We need to learn this. We need to wake up to this or we are soon to destroy ourselves. At the present rate, the mangroves will all be gone in 10 years or so. Then what? What lives, what depends on the fact that this planet has had mangroves for millions and millions of years? Well, we don't know. And that's just not even the tip of the iceberg. That little issue, that's a big issue, but compared to the whole thing, it's a small part of it. So this problem that we have with dualism, getting caught up in our dualistic thing, is very serious. It has major ramifications, not just for you in your own personal life. As I mentioned before, if you can see how it is that we get caught in this dualism, you'll eliminate a great deal of trouble and difficulty in your own personal life. But for us, human society itself, it has enormous problems. And it is something that we need to appreciate and take to heart to some degree. There's other kinds of examples too. I don't know, I hesitate to give some of these, but just to throw them out there maybe a little bit. But like some of the things we're starting to uncover about the natural world. In physics, for example, a lot of the conundrums, maybe I won't go into these, I guess, but some of you have heard, go into them? Oh. Some might like it, yeah. But I think you've all perhaps have heard, haven't you, maybe, you know, that some of the things that physics now is uncovering about the natural world are absolutely baffling to us. We don't understand. How can the world be like this? You know, where you have a photon going through two slits without dividing. You know, they've done this repeatedly. That's one way it's been described. That doesn't make any sense. Well, there's nothing wrong with nature. Nature knows what it's doing, so to speak. I mean, nature is doing it the way it's done. It's our thinking. And the physicists don't quite understand this yet. I'm working on it, and I'm trying to... I got to do another book on this, get more to the point, because it wasn't understood. But the thing is that we are caught up in our dualistic thinking once again. And that is why when we take a very close look at nature, it looks baffling. It looks impossible, paradoxical. It cannot be like this. How is this possible? But the fact is it is like this, and we don't seem to be able to grasp how it is. That's because we're caught up in our dualistic thinking once again. So without going into any details, and I could easily, but I don't want to bore you without, or some of you might be bored anyway with that. But the point I want to make here is that once again, on a very profound level, just understanding the nature of reality, just physical reality as we find it here in this world, we're very confused. And we are operating in a way that is completely out of touch Because we're caught up in our dualistic thinking, we're operating in a way that is completely out of touch with the way things actually are. And yet we are carrying on as if the way we are thinking of it, the way we are conceptualizing it and explaining it to ourselves in our mind, is correct, is right, is true, is real. We don't appreciate the fact that actually we are all absolutely, totally insane in terms of our thinking. If you recognize that your thinking, no matter how you want to think of it, is out of step with the way things actually are, well, then you'll start to behave in a different way that won't exacerbate this problem, nor will you be endlessly frustrating yourself with trying to figure out what's going on here. In other words, by trying to solve that problem by coming up with some kind of an answer, whatever answer you come up with is still dualistic, and nature, reality, is not. Oh, I had some other examples. In fact, I was afraid of this. I'd forget, so I wrote them down. But there's a lot of different things that would fit into this. Oh, yeah, well. One of the biggest conundrums in philosophy, I've been told through my reading. Yeah, I mean, Bertrand Russell brought this one up. For him, the big secret, and other philosophers have said this as well, but he said it so succinctly. He said, for me, the big question is, why is there something as opposed to nothing? Dualistic, right on the face of it. Why is there something as opposed to nothing? Well, why do we think there is something as opposed to nothing? That seems so terribly obvious to us. Well, obviously there's something as opposed to nothing, you know. And Bertrand Russell, well, why? Why? Why is it? And he thought this was like the ultimate question. But the Buddha actually dealt with this question 2,500 years before Bertrand Russell asked it. He should have studied a little bit of Buddhist thought. But we've had this one here, too. I've brought it up. Well, the Buddha said, with those who see, perceive with right wisdom, the arising of the world as it has come to be. The notion of extinction doesn't exist. And for those who see with right wisdom, the ceasing of the world as it has come to be, the notion of existence doesn't occur. So in other words, if we see correctly, in other words, in a non-dualistic way, and we are capable as human beings of doing this, and this is to wake up and to see what is actually here. It doesn't fit into a conceptual form, and yet we can see it, and we can see it correctly, and we can see it in such a way that we understand what it is that we're seeing. Okay, this is awakening, this is enlightenment. And it is neither existence nor non-existence, and that is precisely what we find here. And it is non-dualistic, and this, the ultimate question of Western philosophy, has been dissolved. We haven't answered it, like, why? Because it's a wrong question, in a sense. There isn't something as opposed to nothing. And, of course, there isn't nothing as opposed to something. We can't say that there is nothing here. Obviously, something's going on. But it isn't. There's no particularness about it. There's no thing here. The particularness, I mean literally the particleness of not just physical reality, but ideas and thought as well, is the working of mind itself, which is the collapsing of reality out of the whole and into the part. And this can be seen and known and understand directly. And when we do realize that this is actually the fabric of reality, it has a nature like this, there's nothing mysterious about it. And the conundrums of physics, too, by the way, then are resolved. Schrodinger's cat, for example, for those of you who might know that. How can we have a cat that's both alive and dead? Well, we can't, but a cat is a conceptualized thing. It is a permanent thing, an enduring thing, but actually we don't find anything like that. It just looks like we have something. It looks like we have existence here, in other words. But the Buddha said with correct wisdom, seeing the arising and ceasing of the world as it has come to be, we wouldn't think that. We wouldn't presume that we have an enduring thing here in the first place. But to the extent that we do see a cat and have a cat in some fashion, it's been conceptualized. Yeah, now we have a cat. But of course, in that circumstance, the cat has to be either alive or dead. There's your dualism. And the dualism appears just like this. So there is dualism in this world, but this dualism that shows up in the world is appearance. It is the way we think of it. It is the way we put it together, the way it's been constructed in our minds. The world itself is not dualistic, once again. We are back to that. If we can see that directly, we have resolved the anxiety, the worry, the fear about me, about my life, about the world, about the environment. All of this is cleared up in our mind, and how to behave, how to think, how to act, how to live on this planet. All of this will follow in a correct way, a way that matches reality, from understanding this snag point that we all suffer from. It is subtle, it is profound, it is something we need to come back to repeatedly, again and again. What are we talking about? To notice your mind grasping. To notice how it is that you think that the way you put it together, the way you reach for it, the way you explain it to yourself, is the way it is. We can understand that this is just kind of provisional. That the way it really is not graspable, yet it can be seen and understood and known. And in fact, this is actual true knowledge. Well, there's a lot of things in here. The 46th case of the Blue Cliff Record, where the teacher tells the student, you know, human beings are inverted. They lose themselves and chase after things. Once again, he's talking about the same thing, drawing our attention to this. The flag in the breeze. You know, Alan, two monks arguing, is it the flag moving? Is it the breeze? You know, and they're arguing back and forth. And Hui Neng, sixth patriarch, he overhears their argument. He says, not flag, not wind, mind. The fact that there's this movement, this change, this flow of experience with no particularness about it, that's mind. Now we even have the basis to understand mind, mental experience. The mind is not mysterious. Consciousness is not mysterious when we see it in this way. If we don't see it in this way, we look for it in particularness, and how can these amassing of particles and things called the brain produce consciousness? And we approach it in that way, and we're absolutely baffled by it. We can't make any sense of it. It doesn't seem to make sense. Not only that, how is it that this brain, in looking at these physical experiments, physics experiments, cause things out there and phenomena to change just simply by the fact that this brain is not aware of it? It doesn't make any sense. And of course, it doesn't make sense. But that isn't what's going on. That is only going on in our thinking, in the way that we've constructed it, in the way that we put it together in our mind, the way we've conceptualized it, the way that we are trying to grasp it and trying to explain it to ourselves in terms of particularness. It cannot be explained or known or understood, reality, in those terms at all. And that is dualistic. But we can see and know directly what is going on. By observing with right wisdom the arising and ceasing of the world as it has come to be, as the Buddha described it 2,500 years ago. Another thing that we should be watching for, and I use this like in my books and that, you know, I'll tell stories. People like that. I know I tell stories in my talks and classes. But now you should ask yourself, well, why do you like the story? Well, it's because in the story, it becomes very conceptual, very conceptualized. And of course, we like that. I like it too. And I like to use them because the stories can be used to direct your attention in particular ways to notice this or that. But as Zen students, you know, we need to appreciate the fact that ultimately it cannot be put into a story form. And that as it is explained, that is never it. It's so easy for us to take the story, to grasp it. Oh, I like this story, or, you know. And that's fine, but we think that that's the end of it now. No, I got it. I got the story. I got the analogy. I got this or that. Well, what you've got is another idea, another concept. It is dualistic. And therefore, it isn't the same thing as enlightenment or seeing or really understanding just what is taking place here. So this is very important to understand as well. And I'm saying this because there are times when I teach, I use stories partly to illustrate a point or direct your attention, but also just kind of throw in a little bit of leavening once in a while. Like perhaps this talk right now needs a little leavening, you know, a little lightening up, a few gaseous balloons of air here to expand it a little bit, lighten it up a little bit. And stories will work in that way. But why do they work in that way? Because what you get in the story is that graspable thing. And I know that this is a kind of a dangerous thing. I don't want you to grasp too much or to hang on to it, to be confused by your grasping and thinking that somehow you have the answer. Because what it is that you really need to contemplate, and you know, it won't come to you quite so comfortably. It'll be a little bit out of step with the way you're putting things together in your mind. It'll feel a little dense. Maybe a little uncomfortable. What exactly do you mean here? I don't quite get this teaching. Well, what I'm going to say, I'll talk more about this when we have this discussion on how to study Buddha Dharma. That's all right. Never mind. Don't grasp. Suzuki Roshi said, you know, when the talk is over, you don't need to remember what it was said. But of course, if you tell a story, that's easy to remember. You can grasp that. Of course, it might get twisted and changed in your mind or whatever as you repeat it now. But there's this other stuff that is going on that you can't really grasp and you can't hang on to and you can't remember. And you don't need to. But what you do need is to come back to this kind of pointing out something about the nature of reality, the nature of our existence here, that is going on outside of the story, outside of the explanation. Because that is where the real teaching is taking place. And the other stuff, the leavening, I think it's necessary. It's probably more necessary just to kind of hold us here, to give us a little bit of, you know, something that makes us feel like we're getting something. But what it is that you really need to get is something that will just kind of sneak in the back door somehow. Kadagiri Roshi used to speak of it as it just comes in through your pores. You're sitting here listening and you're thinking and all that, and you think that that's where it's all is. But the real teaching is coming in through your pores. And I thought he was just sort of, humoring us or something like that. I mean, obviously, literally, it doesn't come in through your pores, I suppose. Or does it? I don't know. But what he was saying there, I understand now what he meant. And it is really true. And the most important thing about this to remember is that we just need to soak in this, to come back to it, to remind ourselves of this. And in effect, all it is reminding ourselves of what it is that we actually already truly do know. Well, but there's a lot more I could say, I guess, about this matter of dualism. We'll come back to it from time to time. But as you encounter in your readings or whatever, this discussion or this talk of dualism, little by little, just see if you can get some taste of just what this is and how essential it is and how right to the heart of it. It is neither sacred nor profane, neither existing nor not existing. This is the reality that we are in. We only need to awaken to it. Any bit of grasping you do with it is fine. It's not that you shouldn't, but just realize what that is. That the grasping and the way you hold it and the way you explain it, that's not it. The way it is just something they're waiting for us to see. And at some point we'll see it so clearly that we'll see it all. And I mean, we will see it all. There won't be any mystery. There won't be anything left out. And it will be understood. The details, no, never. But the whole thing can be understood. The details we can talk about, but they're delusion. The whole thing we can't talk about. But the whole thing we can see, but now you can't talk about it. It's kind of like that. John, you had a point?
I was just thinking about the dance between form and emptiness. Or Ramana Maharshi said that you're not the doer, but you still go out and make decisions and act on them. Mm-hmm. And then the monk who denies form wants to stay in emptiness gets whacked.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah. If you're not a body, then you wax. And how's that feel? But sort of that another person said that there's false dualism and there's real dualism. I don't know what he meant by that, but
false dualism is real dualism?
No, there's false dualism and there's also real dualism.
Oh, yeah, right.
Not based on our creation, but
yeah.
So that dance, but I was just wondering if you talk about that.
Well, the idea of the the monk there, thinking that he just wants to be in oneness or emptiness, of course, that's dualistic thinking right there. And yeah, he should be whacked. Whacked back into, you know. Where are you? You know, as soon as you're whacked, you realize, well, here I am, you know. You're not an emptiness. If there's a you, what do you mean emptiness? Emptiness is there's no you. You know, and this goes on even though our bodies don't disappear. That is what's going on now. It's just a matter of seeing that. Seeing beyond the dualism. And seeing it in ways that I've suggested, pointed to even now, that, you know, we look at it this way, you see it all individualized. You look at it a different way, you can't separate anything out. I talk about the puma and the environment, you know. We think we can look at the puma, you know. I mean, here's a puma, and we can see it, here's about so long, you know, weighs so much, and there it is. I see its footprints and tracks, and there, that's the puma there. We can study everything about the puma. But if you really want to understand the puma, pretty soon you have to understand its environment and everything else that's connected to that. If you really want to understand that puma, you have to forget about the puma, you know, and let the whole universe act. You know, then you can understand what we really have here. But that's dualism. Now, of course, in a dualistic way, you know, it's not that the dualism is wrong or bad. Now, this is very important to understand. People think that somehow dualism is the bad guy now. That's thinking still in terms of sacred and profane. See? There's a subtlety to this. Just realize whatever it is that we're calling profane, sacred, dualism, and non-dualistic, that itself is dualistic. But just realize that this is just a way of talking about pointing it out. There's something else. Let the mind take a leap to see what we really have here. And that, we could say, is really to live in emptiness. But it is not I am living in emptiness, or I choose to live in emptiness. That's real confusion. And that was the monk's mistake. So who lives in emptiness? Nobody in particular lives in emptiness. Of course, we're all in emptiness now. But the moment you grasp a self, it doesn't seem that way. I am here in a world of solidity and real stuff. Yeah, that's one way of looking at it. It's not bad or wrong. But if you think that that's it, now you're filled with anxiety, fear, confusion, difficulty, pain, suffering. If you realize that that's just a way of looking at it, and it's real enough, but it's just a way of looking at it. There's another way. You can see this too. This other way. Of course, sometimes people will leap over there and think, that's a nightmare. No. Then you get these two and put these together. The class I'll be teaching this fall, Introduction to Zen, we get into this in the text, The Merging of Difference and Unity. But we'll talk about that. It isn't one or the other. You know, and all these two things that seem to be completely different, difference and unity, how can they merge? But they are merged already. It's not that we have to merge them. If you just look, you'll see that they already are merged. It's in our thinking that pulls everything out. Well, somewhere in there I did actually answer your question, but I think I went. Yeah, Mike.
A lot of times the people that want to save the environment approach it with the same dualistic idea as the people who are destroying the environment.
Exactly. That's why we need to understand, you know, on a profound level, this, you know, the fact that we get caught in dualism, that our thinking is dualistic, we get caught by that. And now we can go ahead and think and plan and make some moves. But it was interesting that one ecologist who did say, but you notice that all of this took care of itself,
right,
you know, before we came along and tried to fix it. Of course, most of us weren't out there trying to fix it. We were just trying to get what we could.
Yeah.
But now others are coming along trying to fix it. But, you know, the best fix we could give in most circumstances is leave it alone.
Leave it alone, yeah. Get out of nature's way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and there's, you know, there's a more rational and sane way, a natural way, a realistic way that we as human beings on this planet could behave and get along with the natural environment and allow the natural environment to provide us with all the medicine and food and shelter and whatever it is that we need. this little blue jewel of a planet is rich in providing us with everything. But if we were only sane and understand the nature of reality in the way that we approach it, you know, this could be heaven on earth. And we could learn to do that. It's possible.
Oh.
Yeah.
I don't know how that would be possible. I really don't see how that could be. But not with the progress we've made now. I mean, you can't go back, and to me, it's just an impossibility.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what you mean by go back, but I would say no. I think we need to go forward, but we need to awaken. We need to wise up. I know it's a tall order. Believe me, I know.
It just seems very unrealistic and impossible because.
Oh yeah, yeah, sure, it's impossible.
The progress we've made and what we've got going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's impossible, but you know, in Zen, we don't let that stop us. No.
More dream, less hope. An unrealistic dream of hope, I think. I feel preventative towards that.
Well, you know, let me say this. You know, there's a story of St. Francis. You know, he was hoeing the garden.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody came up to him and said, "What if you knew the world was coming to an end tonight? This is it. When the sun sets, that's it. The end of the world. What would you do?" And St. Francis said, "I will finish hoeing the garden." That is the way to approach life. Sure, it's hopeless. Yeah, it's hopeless. You know, human beings are hopelessly deluded. All right? Now, what are you going to do?
Take a pill.
Well, I mean, sure, we can embrace that hopelessness, enter into it, and just, you know, abandon all hope and just eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we'll die anyway. Sure, we can do that. Or you can take up your life, become sane, realize what is going on here, and you will realize a transcendence of that problem that is not apparent to you. No, it has nothing to do with taking a pill. I've seen several hands nod. I don't know who's next, but okay, Carol.
Well, you're saying that in your book, the idea that you pick up simplicity and you pick up complexity at the same time, maybe we pick up what we label as progress, and if something else comes along with it. I had to be on the roof of my house the other day, and we put a new roof on 2 years ago, and I can already see the signs of wear on the roof. It's like possible in some ways to reverse nature. Mm-hmm. In some way, I mean, it's like it's a constant, our progress, building a house or making.
Yeah, it's called impermanence.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a basic truth of reality.
And it's also the opposite. It's sort of like my progress. It has. Nature will take it back.
Yeah, we want to impede that. We try to establish permanence in an impermanent world. And we'd be better served to understand this nature of impermanence and then live accordingly, live compliant with nature and reality rather than in defiance of it. You know, and we can learn to do that. And whether it can be done or not, whether we do it, and one of the ecologists was talking about the fact that we're probably, you know, well on our road to extinction. You know, some people think that now. The human species, there's just no reason to think that we cannot. And we're in a huge die-off right now. The Earth has had about five of them. You know, the dinosaurs was the last big one. They're in the end of the Permian period, and they pointed out that there was an even bigger one. Over 90% of life on Earth has died off. I say, well, now we're in another one. It looks like we could very well be. Because species were dying off at a rate of, what is it, like 30,000 a year or something like that? I forget what the number was. This is not how it's been up until recently. And this can look hopeless. Yeah, hopeless. And so this is hopeless. You know, we are making such a mess of it, but let's just go ahead and keep making a mess. That doesn't make any sense. We couldn't, each one of us as an individual, try to get sane and deal with it. Is it hopeless? I don't know. Some of the ecologists didn't think it was hopeless. I think it's a matter of if we start to realize what we're doing, you know, we might be able to turn things around. I don't know. I think the earth has enormous capacity to heal itself if we give it a chance, bring it back. I myself was in a hopeless situation. I was riddled with tumors. You know, one time I had my cancer. I had a kind of cancer that, well, later on I went to a doctor more recently, and he looked at my history, and he said, you had a stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in 1978. He says, people didn't survive that back then. And I said, yeah, I know. I know. And in fact, I think even today they have that. They do have better treatments, I believe, for it now. So you can be in hopeless situations. Things can seem absolutely hopeless. And I was absolutely convinced I wasn't going to live more than a few months at one point. And even then, when I didn't die in a few months, I kept thinking, well, this isn't going to go on much longer. But pretty soon a year went by, then 2 years and 5 years. And I still kept thinking, well, it's going to come back soon, sometime. But finally now it's been over 20 years. And after 9 years, my doctor told me that, you know, we may have licked it. But, yeah, you can be in completely hopeless situations. That doesn't mean, you know, and where you can't see any way out, you know. And in the days of when I had the cancer and I was going through the treatments and everything, I didn't see any way out. I thought I was quite sure that this was it. I was, as best I could, I was just trying to keep focused and putting one foot in front of the other. And I was going to watch this. And I wanted to observe this whole process now of dying, close up, from the inside, so to speak. Well, I got deprived of that opportunity. But it's still there. You know, we all have it. I'm only deprived temporarily. You know, but my point is that don't give up in utter despair, even though it's hopeless. The world's going to come to an end tonight. Yeah, okay. Now finish hoeing the garden. Live your life in such a way that it doesn't matter if the world comes to an end tonight. This is the way to live a life and do that. Enter into it completely, totally. If you do that, you will find peace, happiness, sanity, tranquility, stability, intelligence. You will know how to live your life. You will be able to help others. And what other way to live than that? But to take a pill 3 years back and just drink a beer and watch the football game? What? You know, it's all going to come to, I don't, you know. Interesting, too, that I had a brief bout of that when I found out I had cancer and when I got the news that it was pretty bleak. And I was told that directly by a friend, a physician, who, you know, when I asked, you know, level with me, what's the situation, you know, and I had 2-3 months. Pretty bleak. And I remember I had a moment there where, that's what I wanted to do. I just wanted to just throw in the towel, just give up. Well, that only lasted, I don't know, it was just a brief time. Had I succumbed to that feeling, it would have been, I probably would have died. And it would have been torment and torture, you see. No, but I realized, I had enough Zen training by that time. I realized when that feeling, and it was a kind of overwhelming feeling, I just wanted to throw in the towel, give up. You know, just have someone take care of me, make me comfortable. I had a real feeling of that. I mean, but I realized all I had to do was to just straighten up. You know, I had some Zen training, fortunately. And I knew that you just enter into it, you embrace it totally, you just walk it as level as you can. And one of the things I learned, I learned many things at that time, but one of the things I learned is that, you know, you don't know how this is going to develop. It seemed hopeless. Maybe it's still hopeless. It's hopeless for all of us now on this planet as a species. We don't know that. Maybe it is. If we continue behaving in the way we are, probably it is. But maybe we can turn this around. Maybe we can learn. You know, maybe we can change this. Now, Gary.
It seems a hopeless task of saving ecology of the planet. Is this no different than the hopeless task of saving all sentient beings?
Yeah, same thing. And that is the same as just entering into this moment and taking it up completely, living it totally, completely. And that's what we need to do. If you can learn to do that, you will not have a problem. I can assure you, I've been I've been there where the problem was about as bad as it can get in terms of staring death in the face every single day, and a painful one at that. And I was in pain. And I don't mean to put me up now in any way, but I'm just saying that I know that you can take up your life in such a way that you can live it even through a hopeless situation where, and this is the same as to save all sentient beings. That means you yourself become sane. You yourself enter into it completely, totally. You will not have a problem with life. You will not be cowed by it, mystified by it. You will be able to live it. But as I was saying earlier, take this teaching, this practice to heart. We have to digest it. We have to become this. Take it up and do it. Don't just think it or wish it or want it. And this is to save all sentient beings. And this is to save the planet. And it really is. You know, so it's not really hopeless. It's kind of hopeless, but it's not exactly hopeless. Kadagiri used to talk about that. Yeah, the situation's hopeless. Then he said, it's not hopeless. I didn't know what he meant at first when I heard that. But I know what he means now. But David, I know you had put your hand up several times.
How do you deal dualistically with people that are not trustworthy?
Well, don't trust them. What's the problem?
Without making judgments.
Well, you don't have to make a judgment. You're bad. You're not trustworthy, so you're a rotten guy. No, it's just that quietly to yourself, I couldn't entrust this person with such and such. That's all. And that's all it is. And we all change. Just realize that they might think they're a particular person. But if you were caught up in non-dualism, you would realize there's no particular person here. In other words, 5 years from now, you treat them, five years from now, you come meet up with this person, realize you're meeting up with this person who wasn't that person. In other words, there's all this change and flux, and there's freedom in it. But if you have reason to think that, I can't entrust this person with this information or these goods or whatever, well, if you know that, well, then don't. It's very simple. And you don't have to give another thought to it. Like they're bad or whatever. What are they? Well, yeah, they're confused. No doubt. But then who isn't? Most of us are very confused. And if you're not caught up in dualism, then you won't be confused at least. If you are caught up in dualism, yeah, you watch it. There's the judgment. But then this is the thing to be looking for, to notice this stuff rising in your mind. This is what I was talking about earlier. Take this to heart. This is the confusion rising in your mind now. Notice that. And that is the way that we can transcend that, get past that. We probably haven't gone late, but on the other hand, I have seen some hands too. Does anybody have yes?
I just wanted to add a comment about humans in the environment and human progress. It seems the discussion, not necessarily here, but everywhere you read it or hear it, is, well, if only the humans weren't here, the world would be perfect, or if only we didn't progress and do these things to the environment, then things would be better. And I agree that we've been unwise in some of our actions. At the same time, we are part of this environment. We are part of this world, and our progress is our nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the thing that we have to do is integrate our nature with the rest of the nature that's around us. And that's the message I'm hearing from you, but I've heard some other comments that seem to split humans from the world.
Yeah. I can pinpoint precisely where the problem is. It has to do with intention and will. And this is what human beings, like I mentioned earlier, that the animals, they might have, other mammals say, and to whatever degree. I don't know, maybe plants have will to some degree, I don't know. But certainly we have will. I think I can see will, intention, acting in my cats to some degree. But because they can't really abstract their existence here to the degree that we can as human beings, nor do they have opposable thumbs and technology and stuff like this to do a lot of manipulation. Humans in that regard are somewhat set apart from everything else in the fact that we can act intentionally. And to act intentionally is to act in separation and out of dualism. And this is the problem. This is precisely the problem. This was the great insight of the Buddha, the great enlightenment of the Buddha, is to realize this matter that intentional action, we call it karma. I don't like to use the word karma because people get the wrong idea of what it was that the Buddha's insight was as soon as you say karma, but that's what the word was. But it means intentional action. And his great insight was to realize how this kind of action is different, qualitatively different. It's like this is the only difference there is in reality, is this difference between intention, intentional action, and natural action. And human beings exhibit that to a large degree because of our intellect, because of our grasp of technology and all of this that we have now today. We have enormous power over the natural environment. But it's operating in a way that's different, that differs from how the natural environment operates. And it's working to our detriment right now. If we become enlightened, we understand how it is that this differs, you know, we can begin to act in a way that's compliant with natural action instead of through our intentional action as we do now. Like the ecologist said, that the jungle, you leave it alone and you got clean rivers, you got, you know, all the, he was playing all the different little systems all the way down to the little bugs and microbes under the bark of this and that and how this would all work, you know, up to the, I don't know if he was going into that, but I remember seeing this, where like the huge canopy and all the rest of the parts of the jungle and that were all working beautifully, you know, together. No gardener could step in there and duplicate that, you know. But nature does it that way. And what we need to do as human beings is to... Wes Jackson, an interesting fellow, lives down in Kansas, is into agriculture and sustainable agriculture, and he talks about basically what we need to do is to make it small, keep it small, you know. That's what we need to do. Well, anyway, I think I probably better end it because I really feel like we've gone way over, but thank you very much.